Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian.
Shadows are lengthening, the days are getting shorter, and this podcast happens to fall on the scariest day of the year, Halloween. What better excuse to launch an investigation into a literary tradition that grew up around the firesides of the 19th century, where the warmth of hearth and home were offset by the chill of fictional encounters with ghoulies, ghosties, and all manner of other monsters.
It was a Saturday morning at 6 o'clock that I died.
It is very seldom that mere ordinary people like John and myself secure ancestral halls for the summer. A colonial mansion, a hereditary estate. I would say a haunted house and reach the height of felicity, but that would be asking too much.
In the latter part of the last century, there lived a man of science, an eminent, proficient in every branch of natural philosophy, who not long before our story opens, had made experience of a spiritual affinity more attractive than any chemical one.
It was a woman's hand. In life, in its proper place at the end of a woman's arm, I could easily believe that it had been beautiful. But as it lay before me on the table, amidst the heap of papers in which it had been wrapped, I am bound to say that it was not its beauty that struck me first of all.
It is, I confess, with considerable diffidence that I approach the strange narrative which I am about to relate.
Yes, we're talking horror stories. And you heard there some of the chilling opening lines from the classics collected in a new anthology. We'll be hearing later about the affinity between horror and comedy writing from Charlie Higson and Robin Ince. But first, let's go back to the infancy of the genre with a man who knows more about it than most. He's Daryl Jones, a professor at Trinity College Dublin, who has just edited a collection of classic stories for Oxford University Press. Welcome, Daryl.
Hello.
Now, this collection has 29 tales. I wondered if there's a significance to the number. Is there a magic significance to the number 29?
Would that there were. I was aiming for 30. But then I discovered that one of the stories that I wanted to use fell outside of the time limit I'd given myself, which was kind of to stop at the First World War, at the beginning of the First World War in 1914. And so 29 it is. But if you want to read a significance into 29, please do.
Is there a distinct character to the Edwardian ghost story? I always, as opposed to the Victorian, which I always rather thought there was. You know, you're talking about the sort of Conan Doyle type spookiness.
Well, I think one of the things that distinguishes them is that it's that by this time you're coming at the end of what is by this point a very established tradition, so that the rules and the codes are very set and very well defined. It's interesting reading across the sweep of the 19th century. There were no fixed rules, so you get to see a genre making itself up, making its rules up as it goes along in periodicals and magazines of various kinds. You know, so you get the beginning of the ghost story in its modern form, at least, the beginnings of kind of mad science and mad doctor tales, the beginnings of colonial horror, and all of these kinds of things are in the mix, and no one's quite sure what the rules are. I think by the time you get to the early years of the 20th century, the codes have been very, very well set and very well defined, and we're in, by this point, what is often a quite for many readers, a quite comfortable world of the classic horror story or the classic ghost story, many of which are framed by these quite conservative narratives. They're set in places like gentlemen's clubs. I've lost count of the amount of stories that I've read in which, you know, which begin with a couple of gents settling down over their port and cigars in a gentleman's club, and one of them says to the other one, you know, that reminds me of that dashed rum business in Borneo a few years ago. And cue some horrendous tale of mayhem and cannibalism. And you think, ah, yes, I know where I am now. So I think the difference is that by the time you get to the early decades of the 20th century, the rules, people understand the rules.
Some of these tales are really well known, like Dickens's The Signal Man, for example, or Edgar Allan Poe's Berenice. But some of them aren't,
yeah.
Such as, I didn't know about Mary Eleanor Wilkins, or Mary E. Wilkins, as you call her here, and her sort of very spooky Luella Miller, who brings about the death of everyone with whom she comes into contact. This is an American writer. Why is she a classic?
What I was trying to do in bringing together an anthology like this is to produce or to provide a collection which simultaneously gives people what they expect to get. As you say, The Signal Man, you couldn't really do a representative anthology without having at least something by Dickens in there or something by Poe. And then some newer and unexpected ones. I'm trying to remember where I first came across Luella Miller in some forgotten anthology produced at some point in the earlier years of the 20th century, I imagine. And it's stuck in my mind for precisely the reasons that you've suggested. I'd never read a story before, which is, it kind of in some ways resembles a vampire story, but it's a story of a woman who really does bring about the deaths of everybody with whom she comes in contact, or everybody who she gets close to. And I think one of the interesting things is that there are a lot, particularly in the latter years of the 19th century, a lot of ghost stories and horror stories written by women writers and written about women. I think, you know, it's no accident that this is an amenable and a congenial form that tells us something about the kinds of confinement of women. Luella Miller herself is this enfeebled woman whom others feel duty-bound to help out. And so the notion that if women are kept in a condition of weakness and feebleness, not allowed to act for themselves, to work for themselves, to think for themselves, that you're in dangerous territory here. This has consequences which are very detrimental for the community at large.
The other great story by a woman is Charlotte Perkins Gilman's The Yellow Wallpaper.
That's right.
Which is a metaphor or maybe an allegory of domestic imprisonment and how women have been destroyed by, and she is literally destroyed by the wallpaper in her house.
Yes, women trapped at home. This is domestic entrapment, with childbirth involved as well. And it's a story that Gilman wrote as a direct consequence of her own postnatal, very serious bout of postnatal depression, and the great trouble and problems that she had with the whole medical establishment and the way in which she was treated, again enfeebled as though she were an intellectual child. Don't you worry your pretty little head about it. You leave it all to us. And so from that comes this, what I think of as this terrifying and disturbing tale of a woman who begins to see the figure of a woman, a counterpart for herself in some way, but who's trapped behind the wallpapers, can't get out from behind the wallpaper. You have almost this metaphor for the entrapment and the domestic entrapment of women going on in that story. And we're used to thinking of, or I'm used from an academic point of view, to thinking of the yellow wallpaper as a as a feminist classic from the late 19th century. And so we tend to forget that, yes, of course it is. And Gilman herself was a feminist activist. But we tend to forget, it's, you know, this is also a horror story. This is a terrifying, horrifying story, which fits very well into a collection of Victorian horror stories.
Now, you only have two stories by women of these 29. Why has that happened? You just said earlier that there were a lot of women writing
yes.
in this genre.
Yeah, it simply happened that way. And I found myself thinking, when I looked at it, thinking, am I just being horrendously sexist here? Because there are a lot of ghost stories, for example, by writers like Charlotte Riddell or Edith Nesbitt. And I thought, what happened here? And I don't know the answer to that.
Anne Radcliffe.
Yeah.
You don't include.
She's a terrible writer.
That's interesting because she's been written out of this big exhibition at the British Library. Yeah. And is it because she's a terrible writer? Nobody talks about her anymore.
Well,
but she was important.
She was an enormously important writer. She was a very significant theorist of the Gothic. Of course, she's very important in that she's a very major influence on Jane Austen. You know, Northanger Abbey is a response to the Mysteries of Udolpho. It's a response to the Romance of the Forest. But I don't know when was the last time you tried to sit down and read one of Radcliffe's novels. First of all, they tend to be humongously long. And I think it's fair to say that time has not been kind to the works of Anne Radcliffe.
That's a horror story, isn't it,
yes.
for any writer? Now, in your introduction, you talk really interestingly about the terror-horror binary.
Yeah.
And you quote, you have a lovely line from Stephen King. Mm. He says that he puts terror on top, horror below it, and lowest of all, the gag reflex of revulsion. And he goes on, I recognise terror as the finest emotion, and so will try to terrorise the reader. But if I find I cannot terrify him, her, I will try to horrify. And if I cannot horrify, I'll go for the gross out.
Mm.
Is this a distinction that is particularly meaningful to you?
It's one that's become very influential. Strangely enough, it's one which has at least part of its origins in Anne Radcliffe. These are distinctions that she herself draws when she's writing an influential essay that she wrote on horror and the tale of terror. And she made this distinction. She wasn't alone in doing it, but she drew attention to this distinction between terror, which, you know, people often think of as being, you know, in some way elevated, psychological, even metaphysical, the sense of creating this sense of metaphysical dread and angst, which, you know, the best stories, you know, from Hoffman's The Sandman on down, do very brilliantly. You know, I've come to the conclusion that this sense of the creation of an unsettling, uncanny mood and atmosphere is by far the strongest card that the horror story has to play. But I think King is right after that, you know, if you can't do that, then the next thing to do is to go boo and make people jump. A work of art which sets out to make its audience puke has an aesthetic. It's not a very exalted aesthetic, perhaps, but it does have an aesthetic. And, you know, there is something to be said for something which is simply gross and disgusting.
A lot of these writers have a set that there's an aesthetic of restraint, isn't there, which is exactly the opposite.
Oh, yes.
Is that something that's gone now, do you think, from horror?
This is interesting. I actually don't think that gross, violent, shocking, gory horror is in any way modern. It's as old as civilization itself. I found myself watching Pasolini's film version of Euripides' Medea quite recently with Maria Callas. Now, this is culture we're talking about here. But in the middle of that, there's a very gory ritual sacrifice scene in which a young boy is sacrificed to appease the gods and to fertilize the crops. And I thought, I've seen this before. I've seen these kinds of images before. When I found myself watching films like Cannibal Holocaust back in the 1980s, films which were subsequently banned. And then it sort of started me thinking, well, what about the back eye? You know, Euripides' back eye, which is one of the foundational works of the Western literary tradition and has as its centerpiece, its focus, you know, the tale of Pentheus being torn limb from limb by his own mother, who then parades around with his head on a stick. And I think that sets the bar very high for gore and horror at the very beginning. So you know, the modern world has little to teach our ancient forebears about culture, about horror. Horror has been a part of culture and a part of civilization from the very beginning. So there's nothing new and there's nothing clever about showing people getting turned inside out. But there is something that really does, I think, distinguish 19th century tales. And you're absolutely right. It is this sense of civilized, genteel restraint that most appalling episodes are rendered in the most kind of civilized and gentlemanly and courtly discourse. I mean, a good example of this is the story by Rudyard Kipling. Rudyard Kipling, you know, winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature, you know, one of the great writer of the British Empire, wrote a story called The Mark of the Beast, a story which begins with a drunken colonial administrator desecrating a Hindu altar and ends with another pair of colonial administrators torturing, unambiguously torturing a leper in order to revoke a curse. And you think, this is appalling. And Kipling is well aware of how appalling this is. And yet, I can never quite work out whether it's more shocking because it's represented to us in the language of the 19th century novel, which is this language of propriety and decorum.
Now, you talk about the fact that these reflect the terrors of their age. And we're in a different age now. Mm. And you've also edited a lot of M.R. James,
yes,
who is the great practitioner of the ghost story.
Yeah.
I read through a whole volume of M.R. James' stories trying to be frightened. And I couldn't be frightened by them.
Really?
But it was Francis Marion Crawford, actually, who really does it for me, who's another of the writers you include here. Do you think these are genuinely frightening still to us now?
Yes, I do. But I think you have to be... They have to catch you, or you have to catch them, perhaps, in the right mood. There's a kind of compact, I think, going on between reader and text here. Believe me, if you read M.R. James, close to midnight, in a house by yourself, by an open fire, in a leather armchair with a glass of the finest single malt whiskey you can afford, then he works. Then he really does. And it's at that moment that you start to think, am I really alone in the house? What's that noise outside? These are the times that we expect to meet ghosts. We expect to meet the world of the supernatural. We invite it in. So I think we have to be prepared to invite them in.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When it's time to create a website for whatever's newsworthy in your life, whether that's a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or just a blog, go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Richard decided to give his missus a fright on Halloween night. He chopped his head off and hid it in the freezer. But by the time she opened the freezer, he was so weak he could barely say boo. And there was that much blood on the ready meals, her main emotion was one of fury. Footnote. I'm thinking here about a freezer like the one we used to have in our garage, or like the one the thugs put a man into in the film Shallow Grave. A chest freezer, I think, is its technical name. The one in our garage had things like frozen casseroles and pizzas in it. Sometimes I'd put on shoes if I had to go to the garage and get something from the freezer, and other times I'd just go in my socks. You had to walk sideways to get past the car.
That was Halloween by the actor, poet and comedian Tim Key, and it's the shortest of 16 ghoulish tales in a new collection by 16 leading comedians. The collection is called Dead Funny, and I've managed to lure its editor and one of its most starry contributors into the Guardian's Chamber of Horrors to find out more about it. Welcome, Robin Ince and Charlie Higson.
Hello.
Hello there.
Robin, you're co-editor of this with Johnny Maynes, and Johnny was responsible for bringing the very first Pan Book of Horror Stories back from the dead, wasn't he? They were published in 1959.
Well, Johnny's fantastic. He's a real... I mean, I know Charlie knows him as well, and you've been to his house, and his house is just this fantastic parade of every single horror anthology you can think of, and horror spin-off from the 60s and 70s, and original artwork of kind of Christopher Lee from one of Christopher Lee's terribly frightening collections of horror stories. And so we met years ago. It was at the Norwich. In fact, here we go. We're going to probably have a few Norwich links here. Charlie, that's where pretty much you were at college, I think, Lee. But we met at the Arts Centre there, and he was just a real horror enthusiast, and he started to say, what do you reckon comedians would like to do a collection of horror stories? I said, oh yeah, because certainly my generation, you know, the kind of mid-40s, we were brought up on Alan Frank's horror films book and the Pan books and the Fontana books, and I think anyone with imagination, you know, or a lot of people who like working with their imagination also have somewhere within their mind lurking something truly vile, disgusting or flesh-creeping, really.
You've got some pretty high-profile contributors, haven't you? You've got, apart from Charlie, you've got Richard Herring, Phil Jupiter, Stuart Lee, Katie Brand. How did you persuade them to do this?
Well, the good thing about comedians is they're always so terrified that each job might be the last. They'll take anything, whatever the fee. So that really did help their own personal fear of the end of their career being perhaps next Tuesday. But I think it took very little persuasion. I just sent emails or met them at a place, said, do you want to write a horror story? And they went, yeah, actually, I have got one in the back of my mind. And then the great thing was the deadline, hideously, was the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. So while I was up there, and I would keep bumming into comedians going, you've got 2 days. 2 days? But I'm doing 5 shows a day. So they had their own kind of sweaty personal horror as well in having to get these stories out.
I did it because I owed Johnny Maynes one, really. As Robin said, he's got a fairly small house down in Portsmouth, and he has this vast collection of horror books and memorabilia, and I'm a huge horror fan, and the Pan Book of Horrors, which is how I first got to know him with it when he was resurrecting them, were a really, really important thing in the 70s, that they were the sort of illicit books that when you graduated from kids' books to adult books, it was one of the sort of pathway books to adult fiction. I think horror has always been like that for teenagers, and particularly the Pan books were, because they were incredibly gory and nasty, and occasionally would have quite sort of weird sex in them. So they were great for teenagers. and I got to know Johnny, and the BFI was doing a season on Gothic cinema that I was contributing to, and I was going to meet the great George Romero, who made Night of the Living Dead and came up with the whole idea of the cannibal zombie apocalypse, this massively important figure. And Dawn of the Dead, his second film, zombie film he made, that was the real breakthrough film for zombies. Johnny had a copy of the novelization of that George Romero had written. He'd already got the signatures of Tom Savini, who any horror buff will know it was the sort of great horror makeup artist who did all the really gory stuff in the 70s and appears in Dawn of the Dead. And he also had the signature of the Hare Krishna zombie, who is a very important zombie in the book. And he already had these two signatures. He said, oh, Charlie, it'd be great if you could get George Romero's signature in this book as well. And I said, look, Johnny, I can't take the responsibility. What if I lost your book? He said, no, it's a risk I'm worth taking. Do it. And I went there, and I went out for dinner with George Romero and Dario Argento, who produced the film, who is who was the leading doyen of Italian horror cinema, these two gods, and I got them both to sign this book. I had all four signatures. And I got home and realised I'd left it in the taxi and I never saw it again.
No! Oh my goodness, no, no, no.
The thing had these four signatures in it, and somebody would have picked it up and thought, oh, is a book, is it any good? No, it's someone scribbled in the front. Off,
oh, imagine
away.
If that is now, you know, like the hidden reels of Wicker Man, merely road fill for a motorway.
I know,
oh,
it probably that's... is. So when Johnny said, would I write a story for his anthology, I said, well, it's the least I can do, Johnny.
But one of the interesting things came out of your intro, Robin. You said the comedians and writers I usually hang out with were usually the slightly weird kids at school, while others collected football stickers. They hung around comic shops trying to get hold of Monster Mag and imagining whole films in their heads from single stills of decapitated Shakespeareans or frozen Nazis. This is a whole new insight into the comic fraternity, which I didn't... Is it a true picture?
Yeah, I think so. I think there was a fantastic magazine called House of Hammer, which would have these... you must know it, Charlie.
House of Hammer, and then there was Fangoria.
Fangoria then, which turned into the real... Because House of Hammer was a celebration of Hammer films, and it would have these cartoon strip versions of Hammer films. Now, of course, when you eventually saw them, a cartoon strip has a lot higher budget in its own way in terms of what it can do imaginatively. So, like, Captain Kronos Vampire Hunter, a terrible skull-like creature, and in the film, just someone who seems to have some moles on their face to suggest that they're rotting. We had bubblegum cards, Topps bubblegum cards, where you would buy, you know, at the age of 7 or 8 years old, you would buy with your money, it would have a horrible stick of awful chewing gum in it and five pictures of Christopher Lee being staked with hawthorns bleeding around his head, all of these different things. So I think there were a lot of us who, you know, the outsider kids who hung around the cemeteries, we hadn't yet seen The Pit and the Pendulum. We hadn't yet seen, you know, The Curse of Frankenstein.
And there were all those American films that you never saw. I only knew about them from the magazines and the books, you know, The Incredible Melting Man. And that. They didn't show them on the TV. There were no DVDs. There was no internet. You had to imagine all these films. And, you know, if you ever did eventually get around to watching them, they were mostly pretty awful. But there is a huge similarity between writing horror and writing comedy. You're doing the same thing in a way. As a writer, if you're writing for a book or for the screen, you are manipulating your reader or your audience, and you are pressing all their buttons, and you're leading them up a garden path where they think one thing's going to happen and something else happens. If you're doing comedy or horror, and the idea is to elicit a physical response at the end.
So your story, Charlie, is called Filthy Night, and we've mentioned Christopher Lee quite a few times. He is the eminence grise, yes, over this whole collection, isn't he? Yours is about a sort of an old ham actor who's jealous, yeah, of Christopher Lee.
Yes, I mean, I decided, because I've been writing this long horror series, I've sort of exhausted all the ways I can think of to scare people. So I wanted to write a funny piece that was about horror and about our obsession with it. And it is also something of a homage to Johnny Maynes, because it is about this horror actor who has met this horror collector at a convention and goes back to his house. And it was sort of based slightly on my going back to Johnny Maynes' house. And yes, I've come up with this idea of this hammy old English actor who has always been slightly in the shadow of Christopher Lee. And it is about horror, and it is about our relationship with stars and horror stars, yes.
And Tom Baker in one of the great portmanteau, Amicus Portmanteaus, Vault of Horror, as the, yes, angry, vengeful artist.
Well, this is another thing I was going to ask you about. There's quite a lot of score settling in this, isn't there? there's a PR who gets it in yours, Robin,
yeah,
your story, which is called Most Out of Character.
The thing was, I was doing a show all about the human brain and self-consciousness at the time. So I think a lot of what was actually my comedy show, one of the ideas that I found most disconcerting, which is, you know, about free will and about the idea that are we merely puppet dictators of a machine that is merely wandering around and then we ad hoc, you know, post hoc, rather, rationalisation. So it kind of came from that. And then I just, what I always do is I kind of get an idea and then, as people probably notice, I just type really fast. The idea stays around for about a month. And then I suddenly go, the deadline's last Tuesday, hammer, hammer. And so then it kind of, whatever comes out, may well not have been my conscious mind taking revenge on a certain PR. Not the PR for Dead Funny. Absolutely wonderful. Thank you, Tabitha. But another PR.
There's a long tradition in the horror short story, and particularly in those horror portmanteau films that Robin was talking about, of people getting their just desserts. And so, yes, if we're carrying on that tradition... Well, it doesn't happen in my story, but...
Actually, overall, yeah, it ends up, but it ends up awful for everyone in mine. You know, but I think it's interesting. When you, who was your first? I was going to ask. Can I ask Charlie? I just want, because for me, Edgar Allan Poe. I remember when I read him when I was about 10, and I still find the older those stories get, the more fantastically spooky and creepy, and the use of language probably as it becomes more archaic becomes more terrifying. The way that it goes through these fevered minds. And I wondered if you had a kind of...
Well, for me, it was a short story collection. It was things like the Pound Books of Horror, and there were a lot of good horror collections around in the 60s and 70s when I was growing up. And of course, you know, I read them all. I can't remember who wrote most of them. In fact, I can't remember who wrote all of them, but you just read them for fun. And yeah, I did move on to Edgar Allan Poe, but I suppose the biggest influence was, as with most people, would have been Stephen King, whose early books are absolutely fantastic. And if you only know The Shining from the film, read the book, which is 100 times better.
When you were proposing this, Robin, you were told that there was no market for horror short stories anymore. I mean, who's going to read this?
Well, I think there is. I mean, I think, one, we have a generation like Charlie's and my generation, which is we loved these things as kids, and now we have enough money not merely to buy them secondhand or steal money from our mother's purse to buy the Mayflower Black Magic short stories. And I'd like to say now, I've never told you that, Mother, but I did steal 50 pence and then another 40 pence for some of the Black Magic. Yeah, when the zombie movies started again, when there was that sudden, you know, resurrection of, you know, with Shaun of the Dead, the excitement of horror. And we have people as well, like, you know, Reese Shearsmith and Mark Gatiss as well. Yeah, again, comedy, I think, has, you know, the fact that Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright, the fact that, you know, it was through comedy that horror has helped have this kind, you know, has this resurrection. Now people will go and watch serious zombie films and read, you know, Charlie's zombie books, and they can explore lots of ideas.
I mean, it's a tricky one, because I suppose, going back to what we were talking about before, in the 70s, because there wasn't access to DVDs and internet and things, and because teenagers couldn't really get to see most horror films, I think there was probably a much bigger market for the likes of really good, gory horror short stories. And that led to a massive boom with horror in the 70s and into the 80s, horror books, and the sort of heyday of Stephen King and James Herbert and the like. And then in the 90s, I don't know exactly why, but the bottom completely fell out of the horror market. And a lot of the horror writers moved into crime. The likes of Peter James suddenly looked around and thought, nobody's buying horror anymore, but they all love crime. Crime has kind of taken over, and that sort of very dark crime book with the serial killer is doing a lot of the stuff that they used to do in horror books. But what's happened recently is through young adult fiction in the YA market is there's a lot of horror and sci-fi and fantasy books being published in that area now, like my own series, and writers like, you know, Darren Shan, even things like The Hunger Games, you know, on one level you could see that as a horror story.
Now, this is dedicated to the actors Rick Mayall and Robin Williams, both of whom have died. What is the purpose of this dedication?
I think it was just because this year, that, you know, Robin Williams died while we were actually editing the book, and both Rick Mayall and Robin Williams were certainly, for me, enormous influences. In fact, I can blame them for the fact that now, as a middle-aged man, I still seek the approbation of strangers in rooms across the country. And I think that, you know, when you look at Rick Mayall, the beauty of the way that The Young Ones was played, that horror of the pustules, you know, and then the imagination of Robin Williams, the way that he, I think that was in particular just because he just died then, and he, for my generation, I think Rick Mayall and Robin Williams are two of the most important stand-up comedians for making us think, do you know what, I'd like to do that. Rick Mayall, I just think, was, he would, you know, he was cool, he was ridiculous, he was violent, he was, you know, the use of violence in, whether it was 20th Century Coyote, The Dangerous Brothers, The Young Ones, all of those things. So I think it was mainly just because they just died, and we really, they are people that we adored, and really think, you know, two of the most wonderful comedy performers for my generation.
And you're going to actually do a gig around this?
Yeah.
Just the one, or will you be taking it on
tour?
Well,
I'd love to take more of them around, but I mean, I hope we do some more, but we're going to do one at the Bloomsbury Theatre where, with luck, I may well resurrect my Giant Killer Crabs musical, which I did initially with Robin Hitchcock. And also, Charlie's going to be reading some stuff. We've got Stuart Lee and Josie Long, and Josie's probably going to be writing something for the next book, but didn't write something for for this book, Stuart.
Oh, so
who
it's
wrote
the
something.
First of many, this book.
Well, I think we're going to do another one in the middle of next year as well.
But and it's this gig is in the first week of November, when?
It's just after Halloween. And obviously what I really want is I want a small child. It's the Sunday the 2nd of November. And I do want a small child in a red anorak every now and again just suddenly running through the auditorium. Oh, my goodness. We're in Venice now.
I'm sure we can order that for you. Thank you very much for coming, both
Cheers.
Of you.
Cheers.
Thank you.
And that's it for this week. Dead Funny is published by Salt Publishing. Horror Stories, Classic Tales from Hoffman to Hodgson is published by Oxford University Press. Thanks to this week's guests, Daryl Jones, Charlie Higson and Robin Ince. From me and my producer, Eva Krishyak, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.